Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
Hey, good morning, everybody. How you doing? It's not that early. It's not too early, right? No, not too bad. Depends on what time you went to sleep last night, right? All right, well, we're going to get things kicked off. I know people will be rolling in here as we get going, but my name is Eric Metcalf, and I'm hosting this in collaboration with Sean Lovejoy and his team. You'll notice there's some information about what they're up to, their coaching communities, and what they're passionate about. They actually have hosted this entire track, the leadership development track. And today we'll be hearing from John and Dave Ferguson, co-founders of Community and New Thing. Dave is also president of Exponential, and we'll be talking about what it means to raise up leaders and how movements start with one. I'm on staff at Community Christian Church, and I'm also on staff with New Thing, and we're a multi-site church in Chicago. I planted Community's newest location in downtown Chicago in Lincoln Park, so go Cubs. And if you want to know more information about New Thing, we have a lot of information in front of you. One brochure, Leading a Reproducing Network, is about what it means to jump in with one of New Thing's networks as a church plant. Another one is that we actually teach people how to launch church planting networks as well. If you'd like more information about New Thing, just fill out this response card that's in the center of the table. It's white like this. And we'll pick those up after the session, and we'll follow up with you. One last thing, while you're here, we have a lunch that's available today. It's a free pizza lunch. Who here likes free? Raise your hand. Yeah. So if you're interested in learning more about New Thing, we have pizza and fun to be had, and we'll talk more about what New Thing is and what we do. You just need to register. We're about halfway full right now, and it closes soon. So sign your team up if you're interested. Again, that's free. It's 11:45 to 1 during the break, and we'll kick things off, and there's information about where that's located when you register. The last thing is the first two people who raise their hands. One, two, you guys win right here up front. Congratulations, you win a free copy of Dave and John Ferguson's new book, Starting Over. Here we go, let's give it up to these guys for winning, good job. Let me pray for us and we'll break into this. Father, thanks for a time we can come together and hang out and talk about what it means to be a leader in your kingdom. Thanks for Dave and John for always being an inspiration in this area. And we pray your blessing upon this time. It's in your name I pray, amen. Dave and John Ferguson, co-founders of Community and New Thing, let's welcome these guys. Come on up.
All right, good morning. How you doing? Good. You're the early risers, right? All right. I'll tell you what, I want to start, because we got, an hour? And I'll tell you what, I want to start with kind of hopefully what appears to be a simple equation, at least simple to understand, but I think also very challenging to do. So I'm going to throw that up there. Looks like we're losing a little bit of that. Is that the, okay, that's not us, that's them. Okay, sure, you're saying that's. That actually says multiplying churches plus missional people equals missional movements. All right? Multiplying churches plus missional people equals a missional movement. I think this is important because the way I understand, I mean, I think the vision that Jesus had for the church from the very beginning was that the church was supposed to be a movement. It wasn't supposed to be something that you would outsource your spirituality to. Oh, here's a place where I go on the weekends and they help me, you know, kind of develop myself spiritually. It's not a place where you could outsource your, you know, your the spiritual formation of your children. It wasn't supposed to be a not-for-profit. It wasn't supposed to be. It was really supposed to be this movement of people who are dedicated to apprenticing their lives in the ways of Jesus. And I think if we go back to Acts 1:8, what you really see, the very last thing before Jesus leaves this planet Earth, he says, okay, one more time, guys. Let's see if we can get this straight before I take off. We're going to start here in Jerusalem, and then it's going to go to Judea and Samaria and then the ends of the earth. And no matter how you slice that, if you want to slice it socioeconomically, you want to slice it geographically, you want to slice it ethnically, however you want to slice it, I mean, it's starting from here and it continues to spread. What Jesus is describing there is without a doubt a movement. And so the question kind of becomes then, okay, if that's a movement, then how do you actually get there? And I've had the privilege of kind of doing some things with Alan Hirsch. Alan, who I think is one of the foremost missiologists on the planet, a brilliant guy, sometimes hard to understand, but a brilliant guy. And we kind of took a lot of Alan's stuff and said, okay, how do we make this as simple as it possibly can? And I think this simple equation begins to explain what it takes to actually get there. And what it takes is multiplying churches that are filled with people who are on mission, not a third of them, not half of them, not 70, but it's filled with people who are on mission. And you do that over and over again, and pretty soon what happens is you get movement. In some ways, you can almost think of it as like two pedals of a bike, okay? The first pedal is that multiplying churches. And if you want some information on that, I mean, we know this, okay, statistically it's true that new churches have five times as many conversions as do established churches of 10 years of age or older. Okay, brand new churches will see five times as many conversions as established churches of 10 years of age or older. We also know that new churches grow 23 times faster than established churches of 10 years of age or older. Now, you're going 23 times, that's a lot. Well, when established churches 10 years of age or older aren't growing at all, it's pretty easy to get 23 times faster. But the point still remains, okay? More conversions and greater growth happen as you're multiplying churches. So that's kind of that first pedal. But that second pedal, then, if you think about it as a bike, is missional people. And so to reach our full redemptive potential, we have to get every person on mission. Not just a fourth of them, not just half of them, not two-thirds of them. How do we get every person on mission? And pretty soon what happens, if you are multiplying these churches, and think about it, multiplying churches and then missional people, multiplying churches and missional people, pretty soon those two pedals of the bike, you start to get what? You start to get some momentum, and that momentum creates movement. And I think I think this is a simple way to really kind of take a look at your church and go, how are we doing here? If the church was designed to be a movement, how are we doing as far as multiplying churches? Think about it in terms of multiplying brand new churches, multiplying sites, multiplying creative expressions of ecclesia. How are we doing? And then the second thing you have to evaluate is, okay, missional people. How many of our people are actually engaged in the mission? Are we actually optimizing so we're moving towards 100% of our folks engaged in mission? Because when those two things are working together well, that's how you get to movement. So in some ways, with that as a backdrop, I want to kind of tell you a little bit of our story and then turn it over to John to talk about the beginning of some principles that we're going to work through as far as reproducing principles. For me, it started with some words, powerful words of encouragement, when a guy leaned across this breakfast table and just said to me, hey, you can do it. You can do that. And when he said that, it was kind of like someone reached inside of me and like something was off and all of a sudden he flipped it on. It was like something that was impossible suddenly seemed possible. And my hope is that for some of you that have dreams, and maybe this will be that kind of experience even for you. And I guess before I get that, let me back up a little bit. We did a lot of dreaming when we were in college, dreaming big about how God would use us. So when we actually launched, at least had the dream of starting community, it was myself, my brother John, and then a couple of friends from college. And I remember actually in our dorm room in college, we had a map of Chicago. And this map of Chicago, if you think about Chicago, you got kind of Lake Michigan there, you got the Indiana border here, Wisconsin border, and Chicago is kind of like this, right? That's Chicago. And so since there was four of us, John, myself, our friend Darren, our friend Scott, we're like, okay, how do you reach, you know, the 8 million people in Chicagoland? And so this was our genius strategy for how we were going to reach all of Chicagoland. We just took a marker, so we had this map up there, and we just went like this, and then went like this, and I said, okay, hey, John, you get that 2 million, I'll get this 2 million. Scott, you get that 2 million, Darren, you get that 2 million. There you go. How hard can this be, right? And that was kind of our strategy. And it was certainly grandiose and definitely naive. And it was sometime after we'd launched Community that I began to kind of rethink some of these things. It was about a year later. And I was actually sitting in a little Mexican restaurant. And sitting there I was supposed to meet somebody, and the progress didn't show up. And so this time, once again, sitting in this little Mexican restaurant, I kind of drew a map of Chicago again. You know, you got the border, you got Lake Michigan there. But this time I thought, well, what if I started drawing circles? What if you had one church that was constantly kind of reproducing into every one of the neighborhoods throughout Chicagoland? Chicago in particular is a city of neighborhoods. And throughout all the suburbs of Chicagoland area. What if you had a church that everybody didn't have to come to one place, but was constantly kind of reproducing all across Chicagoland? What would that look like? And so I actually drew it on the back of a little napkin. I was sitting in this Mexican restaurant, and I looked at it, thought about it for a while. and I stuck it in my journal. And I stuck it in my journal, and it stayed there for, you know, I don't know what, the next three or four years. And that's when I was having this breakfast with this guy named Larry. And I was having breakfast with Larry, and I remember Larry just kind of, we were talking about the church. He was an entrepreneur. I was a church planner, so we had some things in common. And I remember he said, so Dave, what's the dream? If you could do anything, if you could do anything with this brand new church, what's the dream? What would you like to do? And first I didn't say anything. There's something about, I think, saying your dream out loud that's kind of risky. You know what I'm talking about? You got some stuff inside you. You go, man, I would love to do that someday. But once you say it out loud, it's kind of like you commit yourself to it, isn't it? And so I think the first time when he said, hey, what's the dream? I was afraid, even if I didn't recognize it, to actually say it out loud because I was like committing myself to it. But he kind of kept pushing me. He said, what's the dream? If you could do anything, I'd love to know. And so the first time in 3 or 4 years, I pulled out that napkin out of my journal. I slid it across the table. And I said, you know what, Larry, if I could do anything, and I showed him this right here, I'd love to figure out how could we be a church that was continually reproducing all across the city and suburbs of Chicago. And just as plain as could be, he just looked back to me. He looked at the napkin, looked at me, and goes like, ah, you could do that. You can do that. And I don't know how to tell you, but I'm telling you what, it was kind of this powerful thing to have someone that I respected, that liked me, and I liked him, look back at me after hearing my dream and go like, no, you could do that. You can do that. And I'll tell you what, let me just say at the outset here, if God has placed a dream, and I thought it was interesting what Irwin said yesterday about the Acts 2:17, that man, what the church needs visionaries and dreamers. And if God has given you a dream, and it comes from God, and he's given you a vision of what you're supposed to do, we would love to be the people who look at you and go like, no, you can do that, and you should go after it. You should go after it. I mean, if you go back to Ephesians 2:10, it says in there, it says, there's a good work that God, I love this, prepared in advance for you to do, right? It says there's a good work that God prepared in advance for you, okay, in particular to do. And I think you believing that about yourself, that there's a good work that God prepared you to do that contributes to his overall dream. Are you tracking with me on this? And also then you believing that about the people that as you look out on Sunday morning, if that's the case, or whatever your ministry is, and you look out and see those folks out there, you believing that about yourself and you believing that God also has that for them, that is the catalyst for movement. I think that is the catalyst for movement, because in many ways what that is, that's really just faith. You believing it's true what God said about you, but you also having the courage to also believe it's true about what God said about other folks as well. And I think in the kind of Alan Hirsch talks about it this way. He says it's like the seed that becomes a tree that becomes a forest. It's like a spark that becomes a flame and then a raging fire. It's like this drop of water that becomes a wave and then kind of a typhoon. And I think you believing that about yourself and you believing that about others is that catalytic event that really begins to make things happen. We've been very fortunate. I mean, since then, communities continued to grow. To be a rather large church where we now have locations across the suburbs and even in the city of Chicago. We started something called New Thing. If you're interested in that, I think we invited you to our pizza lunch. We'd love to have you come and join us for pizza. But we now went from, we'll talk about this a little bit too, just a couple churches that we were able to start. Now there's more than 1,100 churches globally that are committed to being reproducing churches. And even the opportunity to be a part of Exponential and encourage, you know, church planters really around the world and across the country to be multiplying and reproducing church has been a really, really cool thing. So that's kind of where it started for us at Community, and that's kind of where we are today. But kind of before John kind of gives you a little bit more on who we are and some of the principles, I want to back up a little bit and just show you one story. Because at our heartbeat, okay, the thing that really makes our heartbeat fast is helping people find their way back to God. All right? I love the diagrams of reaching the city. I love New Thing, you know, getting to be a part of a church planting network that's now starting to do stuff internationally. I love getting to be a part of Exponential and hear all the, you know, all the cool stuff that's happening around the world. But the thing that really makes our heart beat fast is when we see, you know, one person or one family be transformed by Jesus and find their way back to God. So this is one story. We can take a look at this, and hopefully it gives you a little bit of a flavor for who we really are and the things we're passionate about.
My journey started when I was 2 years old, and my mom and my dad divorced, and we had lived with my grandmother for a long time, and my grandmother and I did not have a good relationship. I met my ex-husband when I was a junior, met at a bar. I didn't really know who I was, though, at 16, 17 years old, to be in love or even know what it meant. It was just something was missing, but I just was so in the moment and wanted, like, to get married and the whole fairy tale that I kind of pushed those feelings aside. Once we had my daughter, it definitely took a turn for the worse. His behavior changed and my behavior changed. And then once I found out I was pregnant with my son, I felt like I was just stuck. You know, I have two kids and I definitely don't want to be a single mom with two kids. So I knew something had to change, and I just kind of went the wrong way to make that change. I had an affair, and then on Father's Day weekend, I had another affair. I think from the beginning of being with a grandmother that treated me like a piece of crap to now being in a relationship that I'm just destroyed and slept with multiple men, but there was no God. And if he was there, he was not a nice person. So, I mean, I would pray, but I didn't know who I was praying to. I just kind of, someone's there, so hear me, and you probably hate me, and why would you let this happen? The last affair I had turned into a relationship. It lasted 3 years, and it was a living hell. I was emotionally and physically abused, and my son was physically abused. Scissors being thrown, TVs being thrown, you know, me locked in a room with a gun to my head. And they were just on the other side screaming. And during that time, I became a drug addict. I was on coke, and I drank a lot. And it lasted 3 years because I didn't know how to get out of it. So the only way I was able to get out of it was I moved. So I moved and didn't know where I was. Before I moved, I met my now husband. The first day I met him, we, like, literally an hour after I met him, we ate at a TGI Fridays. We told each other stuff, and there was no judging because we both were there. We both had similar stories. It was scary. So I sobered myself up. Still had no God, but just knew I needed to do something because I was probably going to lose my kids. So we decided to get married, and before we did, we found the church. Everyone was amazing with our kids and where they should go, and it was life-changing. It is life-changing. It was amazing. When once the first service that we went to, we knew we needed to get baptized before we got married, that we needed to wash all the sins that we have committed in our previous marriages before me and him committed to each other. For years, many years, my husband and I both tried to do it on our own, and that wasn't working. So now we have a place that we could turn to when we need it. It's a relief. It's definitely a relief in any part of our relationship. If we have a troublesome moment, we turn to God, we pray. We're not going to drugs and alcohol and affairs. We're going to God. So that is a relief to have that. In our small group, people who message me daily, what can we pray for you about? It's an awesome feeling. It's a place that I am comforted and loved unconditionally, no matter what. It's what a home should feel like, and it does.
I love that. It's what a home should feel like, huh? And it does. And like Dave said, you know, we love to talk about big dreams and visions and strategize and throw maps up on the wall and try to figure out what our next step is in the journey. But really what drives us and what wakes us up in the morning, what makes our heart beat fast, is when people like Carissa find their way back to God and experience a hope and a fulfillment that they couldn't find anywhere else. And so I hope that inspires you too as you think about what it can look like to fulfill this Acts 1:8 Jesus mission. You know, Dave talked about this equation. Multiplying churches plus missional people equals a missional movement. I think that's what we all want to see. I mean, that's what this whole idea of level 5 is that we're talking about this week here at Expo West. And, you know, when Jesus gave us that vision, he said, you will receive power, right? Yeah, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. And I don't know how you think about that, but, you know, for a long time, I've known that I need to believe in Jesus. I think we'd all, everybody with me on that one? Okay. Anybody not? Okay. But what I'm finding is not only do I need to believe in Jesus, I need to believe that Jesus believes in me. You know, I need to believe that Jesus believes in me. And I think he was saying, I believe in you. And he says, no, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you. You will be my witnesses. You will be the ones who carry out this message to the ends of the earth. And so people like Carissa, her husband, you know, that's what gets us excited about this. I want to tell you a little bit more about the beginnings of community. And when we started, we had a threefold vision. And it looked like this. I'll go ahead and write these on the flip chart here. It was a threefold vision. And the first phase of that vision was we wanted to be an impact church. Three words will kind of represent the threefold vision: impact church. And to be an impact church meant that we would be a church that was just relentless about reaching people who are outside of a relationship with Jesus, people like Carissa. We weren't interested in people who were already attending church. Our intent was to reach people who were far from God. Not only that, we also wanted to be the kind of church that, you know, if it just suddenly disappeared, if one day, poof, you know, the church was gone, that people in the community would actually notice, you know. And not just the folks that show up for services on weekends. I mean people in the community that may be part of another church or know very little about what happens inside the walls of that church. Say, hey, you know what? This place, this community was better when that church was here. What happened? You know? So that was what our idea of an impact church would look like. So that was the first part of our vision. The second part of our vision was that we would like to be a reproducing church. A reproducing church. And even in the beginning, you know, we weren't content with simply growing one large church that would reach a lot of people. We thought we could reach more people by growing large, but we also thought we could reach more people by reproducing over and over again. Now, at that time, the idea of multi-site was virtually non-existent, you know, one church in multiple locations. So we assumed that this would be done through church planting. And really, we've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to be about multi-site, a church in multiple locations, which we do throughout Chicagoland. And now we also have New Thing, which is our church planting mission, which has over 1,000 churches now that are part of it worldwide. So that was phase two, to be a reproducing church. And then the third part of this vision was, I'll use the word catalyst. You know, if God would so bless what we're up to, we would love the opportunity to be a catalyst for a movement of reproducing churches. And yeah, I mean, our vision was to have an impact far beyond the city of Chicago or even the United States. We hope to one day see a movement of churches. Our team talked about this. We committed it to prayer. But it's interesting, early on when it was just like the five of us, Dave and myself and Scott and Darren in Georgia, we wouldn't often share this part of the vision with other people. And this is even before we started, we came up with this threefold vision. And I don't know if we didn't share it because we were naive or arrogant, maybe a little bit of both. But in our most courageous moments, we would say, you know what? Okay, if God would bless what we're up to, we'd love to see just a movement, you know, something beyond our wildest dreams that God could do through this new church called Community Christian Church. You know, at the time, there were five of us, and we were, you know, actually four of us, I guess, at that time, meeting in a hen house restaurant in rural Illinois. And so, you know, I guess some folks might say, hey, you boys might want to try starting a small group before you start thinking about, you know, catalyzing a movement. I don't know. Maybe that's why we were hesitant to talk about it. But that was our vision from the beginning, was to be an impact church, a reproducing church. And then if God would so bless what we're up to, we could catalyze a movement of reproducing churches. And so that actually took us about an afternoon to come up with. And it took us about a year and a half after the church started when we finally landed on this phrase that Dave already mentioned, that would become the mission of Community Christian Church. And I remember we were at a small group training conference, and it was led by a guy by the name of Lyman Coleman, who is actually the brother of Robert Coleman, who wrote Master Plan of Evangelism and several other books. He's with the Billy Graham Association. And Lyman went across the country leading people in these small group training seminars. And just about every time he would lead one of those, I went to several of them, he would, with just tremendous passion, retell the story of the prodigal son. And when we heard him talk about that and share with just passion the desire that he had to reach people who were far from God, we were convinced right then, okay, that's going to be our mission statement, helping people find their way back to God.
Because he told us, he said, you know, there are prodigals in every single one of our communities who desperately need to find their way back to the Father. And so that became our mission statement about a year and a half into the life of our church. And I love that statement because I think it resonates with people almost no matter where they might be on their spiritual journey. It doesn't really make a project out of anyone. And we kind of like to say that finding your way back to God is a life-changing moment, but it's also a life-growing process. You know, finding your way back to God is a life-changing moment, but it's also a life-growing process. I read an article recently in the Harvard Business Review that said a good memorable mission statement is 8 words or less. 8 words or less, okay? So I'll tell you what, just to kind of get us talking a little bit here, why don't you turn to the person next to you and see if you can restate your church's or ministry's mission in 8 words or less, okay? Real quick, give it a shot, all right? Turn to the person next to you, see if you can do that. Restate your mission in 8 words or less. All right, how did y'all do? You got it done? Okay, what's your mission statement?
Ours is people helping people find and follow Jesus.
People helping people find and follow Jesus. That's pretty solid. Yeah, seven is really good. All right, who else has one? Anybody? What'd you get?
Igniting hearts, offering hope to live in freedom.
That's good. I like that. That's 8 words right there. Okay. Yeah, you can't help it. All of a sudden, now you hear, oh, mission statement has to be 8 words or less. You start counting, right? Helping people find their way back to God. All right, we're on. Okay, good. It must be awesome, right? All right, well, the mission of community, helping people find their way back to God, is expressed in 3 ways. And I think we have this on the screen. And we talk about it this way. It's about reaching people who are far from God. First of all, it's about reaching people who are far from God. Luke 19:10. Jesus said he came, what, to help me out? Yeah, seek and save the lost. And my city probably isn't too much different from many of your communities. If the research is still accurate, probably less than 1 in 10 people are actually connected to any life-giving church of any kind. Far too many people are living a life separate from Jesus, and so we need to be about reaching people who are far from God. All right, the second part of that mission, the second way we express that, is not only do we need to be about reaching people who are far from God, we also need to be about restoring God's dream for the world. Restoring God's dream for the world. You know, Luke 4:18, Jesus kind of launched his earthly ministry there, and he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, freedom for the prisoner, recovery of sight for the blind, and to set the oppressed free." And I live on the north side of Chicago, and you don't have to live in Chicago to know that there is a lot of activity in Chicago that does not reflect the dream that God had when he came up with this idea of a city that would be on Lake Michigan, right? We have over 500 murders in the city of Chicago this year. Too many children don't get a good education. There's tremendous misuse of wealth in our city. Too many people are living lonely, desperate lives. That wasn't God's dream. That's not God's dream. The church needs to be about restoring the dream that God had from the very beginning. And then finally, helping people find their way back to God is about reproducing the mission in others. So it's about reaching, restoring, and reproducing. In Luke 10, Jesus sent the disciples out how? Not by themselves, but in pairs, right, in twos. They weren't doing ministry on their own. Jesus spent the majority of his ministry with the 12, right? One study I read a while back stated that in Chicago, we were averaging one church closing every week. And I don't know if that's still accurate, but we need to reproduce this mission over and over and over again, right? And so we're about reaching people who are far from God, restoring God's dream for the world, and reproducing that mission over and over again. And the Jesus mission, helping people find their way back to God, is where those three come together. That's what it's all about. You know, when we started community, there were five of us, myself, Dave, our two friends from college, Scott and Darren, and then Georgia. And, we had no money, we had no people, we had no clue, truthfully. And we did a lot of things wrong. There were so many things we would not repeat. Some things I can't repeat. All right. But one thing we did right, and it was this. Every single one of us on our team started and led at least one small group. Everybody on our team started and led at least one small group. Now, there was only one problem early on in starting small groups. We had no people. And you kind of need people to start small groups, right? And so what our team did, because, you know, we were going to be relentless about getting this church started, is we would actually go to each other's small group. And so almost every night of the week, you're going to a small group. and seeing the same people with maybe just a couple extra thrown in. But imagine, you know, you're showing up in a group and you're hearing the same answer, the same icebreaker, the same questions night after night, discussion after discussion. But that's what we did. The key, though, to every one of those small groups reproducing was each one of us asking someone to be our apprentice leader. All right, don't miss that. The key to every one of those small groups reproducing was each one of us asking someone to be our apprentice leader. And an apprentice leader was simply someone who was agreeing to be developed and equipped to lead themselves. Not a co-leader, not an assistant leader, but an apprentice. And since then, groups of like 8 to 12 or 15 people have reproduced over and over again. And now what we really are is a church of about 10,000 people that really is a large church with a lot of small groups. We're a large church with a lot of small groups. A new thing, our church planting mission is a mission, a reproducing church mission internationally now that's a mission that includes thousands and thousands of reproducing small groups. But I can't state this significance of this enough that we insisted on every group beginning with a leader and an apprentice leader. And that decision was foundational to us establishing this reproducing leadership culture that I believe could result in a missional movement. All right, at the micro level, every person owning this multiplying movement mindset and identifying someone to be your apprentice. And so we want to kind of bring this all together by sharing with you what we would consider to be four reproducing principles that we've sort of learned over the years that we really believe are crucial if you want to have a reproducing culture and really see a movement of God through our churches. And, you know, getting back to that equation that Dave mentioned earlier, you know, multiplying churches plus missional people is going to equal a missional movement. And I think this is foundational to seeing that multiplying church element of that equation. So the first principle is this, okay? I've already shared it with you, essentially. Reproducing requires everyone to have an apprentice. All right? Reproducing requires everyone to have an apprentice. I can't overstate how foundational that was for us from the very beginning. And we were fortunate. I mean, it was like God's blessing on us that we said, okay, you know what? This makes sense to us. Everybody who leads anything needs to identify someone that they're developing. Okay, so second principle then is this. Reproducing is proactive, not reactive. Reproducing is proactive, not reactive. From day one, we decided we would never wait for growth to happen, but instead of waiting for it to happen, we would actually make room for people and pray that God would then send them to us. We prayed that God would make room for we would make room for people, and then we'd anticipate that God would actually bring people our way. I remember our first summer, we started in the spring, and we had kind of a large launch, you know, to our church plant, and we did massive marketing. We had almost 500 people for our first Sunday, and then after that, you know, we were trying to get as many people into small groups and kind of stop the bleeding, because typically, you know, the attendance kind of goes down for, you know, some of you are smiling, you've experienced this, right? Kind of goes down, you're like, okay, what can we do to kind of get these people to stick around and not see this continue to drop off? Well, we kind of experienced that for a while. We started in the spring, and then I'll never forget July 4th weekend of that first year. Is there a pastor or a church leader in the room that loves July 4th weekend? You do or you don't? Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah. We all know why, right? What happens? I mean, the place vacates, right? Unless you're the place that everybody's going to. I don't know. But, you know, everybody's on holiday. And so I remember we're in the high school cafeteria on that Sunday, and there's about 60 adults in a room that would seat like 400. And, you know, after the service, you know, I'm like in the corner in fetal position updating my resume thinking, okay, this thing's not going anywhere. We're done, right? And about that time, Dave walks up to me and he says, John, I think we should start a second service. I'm thinking, all right, it's really got to him. He's delirious. I mean, it was bad, but it wasn't that bad, Dave. But guess what we did that fall? We started a second service. And I think what happened was that we went ahead and made plans to start a second service because we believe that a new service would give more people more options. And I think it was something probably that Lyle Schaller, you know, kind of convinced us would be a good thing to do. But again, what we were doing was making room for people, anticipating that growth would occur, not waiting until we were full, okay, to reproduce, but reproducing proactively, anticipating that God would send people to fill that space up, and he did. And, you know, we practiced that principle on the macro level with services and campuses, all right, and churches, all right, and even networks now. We also practice it on the micro level. We reproduce small groups in the same way. We identify a leader, raise up an apprentice, send him or her out, open a group, anticipating that God will send people to come to that small group. And so it's actually happening on the micro level as well as the macro level. So the second reproducing principle is this: reproducing is proactive, not reactive.
If we go to the third reproducing principle, throw it up there on the screen, is this. Reproducing is not about size, it's about leader readiness. It's not about size, it's about leader readiness. And I think this is a typical mistake that a lot of people think, oh, okay, when your small group gets to a certain size, that's when you reproduce, right? Or that when your church gets to a certain size, that's when you reproduce. Or typically we kind of look at the numbers, we look at a certain size. Our experience has been, yeah, I think size does play a factor, but it's almost always we go back to this idea of leader readiness. I'd encourage you, if any of this is interesting to you, John and I wrote a book where we deal with these principles and kind of tell our story called Exponential. And I think they got it for sale, and I know they got it for sale in the bookstore or whatever it is that we got out here for Exponential. But pick that one up, and in that we tell the story of one of our good friends, Troy McMahon. Troy's a guy who actually started. He was working at General Mills. I kind of tease him sometimes. He was making hamburger helper. He was making hamburger helper, but he was actually kind of on the executive track. And we just kind of hit it off. And so he was in my small group, and I asked him if he would be my apprentice leader in my small group. And I think we'll throw we got that, Sherry, the leadership path. And so Troy started out just as simply as an individual in our church. Just a guy who was going to our church who we kind of hit it off, though. And you could tell he had some leadership potential. I mean, he seemed like a very, very sharp guy, charismatic guy. So we just started. We'd get together for breakfast on Tuesday mornings when he was my apprentice leader. And we'd work together on this small group. Well, it wasn't long before it was pretty clear that Troy had what it took. And I said, hey, Troy, I'll tell you what. Why don't you just go ahead and take over this group? And since I'm the pastor of this church, it's easy for me to attract other people. I'll go start a new group. You take over this group. So he went from being an individual at the church to apprentice leader. Then he went to leading a group, just leading a small group. And because he'd been trained to have an apprentice, he did the exact same thing. And you begin to create this culture where pretty soon people are kind of like unconsciously competent about certain things. They just think they have to get an apprentice leader, which is really a nice thing. And you want to create that kind of culture. And he did. He just went out and got an apprentice leader. And within about a year, he had developed another apprentice leader the same way he'd been developed. And I think maybe John will even take you through some of the five steps in a little bit here. And he reproduced. In fact, he did this a couple different times. And so at that point, rather than him continuing to be just a leader, he said, well, Troy, why don't you step up and why don't you begin to coach other small group leaders? You've been very proficient at it. You know how it's done. Why don't you start coaching other small group leaders? Well, and Troy did exactly that and did a really great job at it. We had the opportunity early on then to actually go ahead and launch our very first, our second site, but our first, what you'd call, I guess most people call a multi-site. And so we were kind of looking around, okay, who could we get that would be what we were going to call this idea of a campus pastor? And so instead of going to churchstaffing.com or instead of looking at a local seminary, we looked inside our leadership path and said, who's the person who's been the most faithful? Who's the person who really buys into our vision? Who's the person who gets our philosophy of ministry and understands who we are? And it shows a real track record of fruit and success. And at that point, then it was obvious. It was like, well, why don't we just ask Troy? And so we did actually. Troy ended up quitting his job, raised part of his own support, and then he moved into actually kind of a director role at first, where he actually kind of did kind of an executive pastor role. And at that point, it was kind of an interim deal because we knew it was going to be about another year. And then we went ahead and gave him the opportunity. He became the campus pastor at our second location. And if we continue the rest of the story with Troy, it was about 8 years later, after he launched that campus and also another campus, that he came to me and he said, you know what, I think I'm supposed to go plant a church. And ended up going back to Kansas City with our blessing and a whole bunch of our people and our resources. Went back to Kansas City where he'd gone to college and was kind of from that area. Planted a church there. Planted a church there. That church then went to multiple locations. And since then now, he's actually planted a couple other networks. So he's actually moved to a network leader. Now you could even add another one if you wanted to now because he's actually oversees about two or three networks there. And they have dreams of planting 100 churches in the Kansas City area. And that's something that happened with an individual over the course of about 15 years. All right? Now, in some ways, that might be kind of a novel story, except that we could actually tell the story of lots of people who've gone through this leadership path. I mean, I could point to another guy named John Sosnowski. John showed up as an individual at our church at the invitation of somebody he met at one of the pizza places in the Chicago area. He began to apprentice in our Kids City ministry. He began to lead a Kids City ministry. we came to him and talked to him about eventually maybe doing something on staff, because he was working for, who was he working for? AIG Insurance. He wasn't quite ready to make that switch. He started leading adult small groups. He started reproducing, okay, other groups. Just like Troy, we said, well, why don't you move into a coaching role? He started coaching other leaders. And eventually when we needed someone to actually be the small group director at one of our new sites, who did we go to? We went to John and said, hey, why don't you come and be a small groups director? He did such a great job being a small groups director, we actually asked him to be the campus pastor at our largest location. And in the spirit of kind of reproducing and multiplying, I'll never forget, John came to me and he said, hey, you know what? I love being the campus pastor here at this largest location, but what I'd really like to do is start something brand new. So he left our largest location to go start a brand new location. That brand new location, I think this weekend, had like about 1,500 or 1,600 people at it. And he not only does that, but he also now oversees all of our networks at our community Christian church. So you think about that over the course of, again, probably about 12 or 13 years, you have a guy who was working at AIG Insurance, doing great, no Bible college, no seminary or anything, but just through this kind of this leadership path, this apprenticeship kind of training, went from being an individual apprentice, leader, coach, director, campus pastor, now he's a network leader. Eric Metcalf, who came over there, Eric back there. Eric, same kind of story. I mean, his path is a little more, what is it, circuitous? Is that the word? I may have just made up a word. I don't know. But, I mean, started as an intern. How long ago, Eric, did you start as an intern? 17 years ago, started as an intern. Basically, he's kind of just followed John. As the whole church kind of keeps growing, he just kind of stays one step behind John. And John, I think you've been a perpetual apprentice of John's. But, I mean, it was an individual, apprentice, led, small coach, small group director. And like he mentioned a while ago, started our most recent campus and does a great, great job doing that. And in between, he was also our new thing director and a whole bunch of stuff. So, I mean, we could kind of tell story after story after story of exactly that. And so I guess it goes back to this principle that we're kind of emphasizing is that reproducing is not about size. It's about leader readiness.
Yeah, this leadership path is a tremendous tool, I think, in helping us equip leaders for more and more responsibility and influence. And, you know, Dave mentioned that, you know, it's so great to be able to look back at people who have followed this leadership path because, you know what you're getting. You've seen what they're capable of. And there's so much less guesswork when it comes to giving leaders more influence and more responsibility. So tremendous tool, the leadership path. Another tool is what we use as a guide for developing leaders at every single level. So if you look at this, you know, individual, or I should say apprentice, leader, coach, director, every one of those people at every single level need to be developed. And so we found this tool to be extremely helpful in developing leaders at every level in that leadership path. And it's a simple process. It comes from 2 Timothy 2, chapter 2, verse 2. And I think we have that verse on the screen where Paul writes to his apprentice, Timothy, the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others. And sometimes we talk about this process as the 2-2-2 principle. Kind of keeps us thinking multiplication, right? 2-2-2, 2 Timothy 2-2. Because if you look at it in this passage where Paul's writing Timothy, he speaks of reproducing leaders into not just one or two or three, but four generations. Four generations of leadership, right? You've got Paul, right? Paul instructing Timothy, that's two. Paul instructing Timothy to invest in reliable people, that's three. Paul instructing Timothy to invest in reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others, that's four. Four. Now think about the significance of that for a minute, okay? Because at the heart of biblical apprenticeship is this idea and practice of reproduction, multiplication, over and over again, so that the mission will indeed be carried out from Jerusalem to Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And, you know, we love using the word apprentice because it reflects this idea of someone aspiring to something more, an opportunity to lead and influence others. An apprentice, again, is not a co-leader, not an assistant leader, but someone who's being equipped. And we know that, you know, leaders require followers for sure, right? If there's nobody following, then you probably don't have a leader. But true leadership is not measured by the number of people following, but by the number of leaders you reproduce. True leadership is not measured by the number of people following, all right, but by the number of leaders you reproduce. And so I want you to do is just kind of think for a minute, all right, in your own mind about someone you are currently apprenticing. Maybe you're already ahead of us on this. You already have somebody that you're developing that's walking alongside you that you're equipping. But think about either that person. Get their name in your head or their face in your mind, okay? Or think of someone that you could apprentice. Someone in your current sphere of influence that you could walk through this process, okay? So give me kind of a nod of the head when you have someone in mind, all right? I want everybody to be thinking about someone as I show you this kind of process. Everybody have one? Okay? Everybody nodding your head? Okay. All right, good. So this is what this idea looks like. We call it the five steps. And you may have seen this before. Some of you might even think, oh, I can't believe he's going to show us this stuff. But, you know, I make no apologies for walking you through this five steps, because the question is not, do you know this or have you seen this before? The question is, are you putting it into practice, right? Are you putting it into practice? All right, so quickly, the five steps. It begins with this. It begins with this step. I do, you watch, we talk. I do, you watch, we talk. And, you know, in this phase, an experienced leader leads a group or a team. Again, it could be any leader at any level, all right? And in this phase, the apprentice is simply observing the more experienced leader in action. And then within a few days, they should meet together to talk about what that experience was like. If you're leading an adult small group, maybe that group, you know, meets on Thursday nights. You're meeting with your apprentice on Tuesday. All right? I can think of Chris, the guy I was most recently apprenticed in one of the small groups that I led. I met with him. Chris was a part of the small group, clearly had leadership promise. People looked to him in the group already for leadership, even though he wasn't the identified leader. I had a conversation with him. I said, Chris, you can do this. I know you can. I see in you the kind of person that could influence others toward a closer relationship with Jesus. Would you be my apprentice leader? He said, yes. So we started meeting regularly, where we'd talk about what, you know, leadership would look like and doing life together and really in a discipleship relationship. And so in this first phase, I said, you know what I want you to do is just watch, just observe for a while, all right? But then every time, every week, we'll get together and we'll kind of talk about how you're developing as a leader. And we'll also talk about how the group's growing and or not growing, how it's doing. Usually three questions we like to discuss in that one-on-one, in that we talk time. It's what worked, all right, what didn't work, and how can we improve? What worked, what didn't work, and how can we improve as it relates to that small group or ministry experience that you're facilitating. So first step is I do, you watch, we talk. Second step is I do, you help, we talk. I do, you help, we talk. Pretty simple, right? In this phase, I said, Chris, okay, you know what? I want you to help out. I'll continue to lead, but I'm going to give you a part of the leadership for the group. Maybe I'll ask him to, you know, follow up on some folks who weren't able to be there because they were sick or out of town. Or maybe I'll ask him to lead the prayer time or the icebreaker or the opener. I ask him to help me in this step. Then step three is you do, I help, we talk. I can remember it was only a couple weeks into Chris's apprenticeship, and I got sick. And I called him at the last minute. I said, Chris, you know, I think we're going to skip a step. Tonight it's going to be you do, I stay home and get well. But the truth is, I mean, Chris was already ready. I mean, he's an outstanding leader. He was more than capable. He did great. But at this phase, you know, it's kind of turning the tables a little bit. And Chris is doing most of the leading. And now I'm helping. And if I'm really on my game, I'm allowing Chris to tell me how he wants me to help him. Because he needs to go and do this with somebody else eventually, right? And so you want him to experience that. And then step four is you do, I watch, we talk. I'm backing off more and more, giving Chris more and more of the leadership of the group. And then finally, step five is you do, someone else watches. And that process of reproducing comes full circle. The former apprentice is now leading, and hopefully Chris is developing an apprentice. Ideally, that leader who has developed and released multiple apprentices eventually gets to coach those leaders that he or she has released over time. And, you know, I mean, this process applies to developing artists also, not just leaders. We challenge our artists to identify apprentices that they can develop as well. You might call that person an understudy or a shadow or a second chair. I'd probably just go ahead and call them an apprentice. But we do know if it takes leaders to reproduce small groups, we know it takes artists, right, to reproduce large groups or celebration experiences. I mean, what we're experiencing in the large room, that's a celebration experience. Thank God we've got some great artists that have been developed, right? We need our artists identifying and developing apprentices in the same way we need our leaders identifying and developing apprentices. And we really believe that these five steps do. I mean, if we could encourage you to take one thing home, I think, today and put it into practice, it would be this right here. And again, it's not do we know it, it's are we really putting it into practice. All right, Dave, you want to take us to the fourth reproducing principle?
Sure, here. We'll wrap this up, and then if you got some questions, we'll spend about 10 minutes kind of doing some Q&A if you want. Here's the last reproducing principle, it's simply this. Reproducing is not about our kingdom. It's about God's kingdom. All right? It's not about our kingdom. It's about God's kingdom.
I think I remember Dave Rache. Dave was the guy who was our student community pastor, worked with all of our high schoolers, and I loved Dave and Heather. It was kind of a really cool God thing that actually brought them to our church, and I was really excited about them actually being the student community pastors for my kids. And so when he came and told me that he wanted to go plant a church, I work with Exponential, a new thing, my gut feeling when he said he wanted to come plant a church, my gut feeling was, oh, crap. You know, like, I don't want Dave to go. You know, send that guy, you know, send somebody else. And in some ways, I kind of dragged, we really dragged our feet on the whole thing. We said, why don't you think about this? And so he thought about it, and I said, well, we talked some more, and I said, well, where are you thinking? He said, oh, I'm really thinking Denver, Colorado, in that area. And I said, I'll tell you what, why don't you go out there, you take a week, go out, not even a week, it was actually less than a week, you go out there, then you come back, and we'll talk some more. So he went out there with his wife and I think another friend or two, and they went out there, and they came back, and we sat down. I said, well, how'd it go? And he said, well, it went pretty good. I said, oh, what do you mean, how good? And he said, well, I've already raised a couple $100,000. I know exactly. You're like, what the heck? That was just like a trip. How did that? And he did. He made a couple of key connections with some two large churches there. They're just like, yeah, we're in. I was like, oh my gosh. And so it was like one of those things where even though I kind of wanted him to stay there, it was like clear God was doing something. It was clear that God was at work. And so it was that point that we kind of got on the other side of it. We said, okay, we need to bless this thing. We need to really get behind it because God's doing something here. So I remember one of our leadership community events where we brought all of our leaders, you know, apprentice leaders, coaches, staff, everybody together, and we do that monthly. And I brought Dave and Heather up on the up front, and I said, hey, I told them the whole story. I said, Dave and Heather, think about going to plant this church. Here's what's happened. It's clear that God's at work. God's behind this thing. And if Dave and Heather are going, then some of you need to go with them. Some of you need to think about going out there and going with them. And over the next several months, we had about 30 folks that decided they were either going to transfer schools. Some were students. Some of them sold their homes, got brand new jobs, and moved from the Chicago area out to the Colorado area to help Dave start this brand new church. And so, you know, we blessed them with people and then quite a bit of money as well. And in many ways, it was kind of funny because it felt like at that point in time that was really a loss for us. And it was in some parts. But I think it goes back to this, and you know, you heard several speakers talk about this yesterday. You know, it's not about my kingdom; it's about God's kingdom. And what happened, and we never would have anticipated this, that actually was the birth of New Thing, because that was the very first church we ever planted. And so while we thought we were losing, I thought I was losing a student minister. Okay, I thought I was losing somebody who was going to be the student pastor. What we were actually gaining was something now that, I mean, like John said, I mean, he's got churches that are reproducing all around the world. And this whole church planting network. And we never, ever would imagine it. And I think that's not always the way God works. Sometimes you just lose and you never know what happened, right? If we're candid. But sometimes it happens like that too. And so I think one of the reproducing principles you got to come back to over and over again is this one. You know, reproducing isn't about our kingdom. It's always about God's kingdom. So there's a whole lot of faith that you got to put into that. All right? Anything you want to say to wrap up? All right. I'll tell you what, so I think we got like 7 or 8 minutes. So before we finish, if you have any questions, anything that we said you need clarifying, or maybe things from your context, going like, how would this apply? We would love to help however we can. Yeah. You can think about this too. I mean, in retrospect now, I mean, there's several. I mean, like, when we coach church planters now, we didn't start with any leadership residents. Like, we would coach church planters. You're starting now. Start day one by having someone you're apprenticing who's going to plant a church. That makes sense? I mean, because you're going through this really high-risk experience of planting a church, but you could bring somebody in who is really almost low-risk for them, but they get to experience it firsthand before they go plant their own. So we would encourage every church planter to think in terms of having a leadership resident. Candidly, too, I think there's some things we just did by accident that turned out to be right. Like, we ended up, because I think we have kind of like an apostolic kind of gifting, we ended up planting another camp, two other locations where we were built a building. But I don't think it wasn't as intentional as I would tell other people now. No, you need to think about, because you want to get that in the DNA from the very beginning. We look back over our shoulder. It was 9 years before we started a campus. It was 12 years before we planted a church. Right? I know you're going like, what were you guys doing? Yeah, and so it was like 12 before we got to. So, I mean, but those things, I mean, I think we would have planted but nobody was planting sites then. I mean, there wasn't even. We would have done that different. Would have gotten the church planting game a lot sooner, not dragged our feet so long. So there's lots of things like that. We even have a financial model now where it's like 10, 20, 70, 10% goes into reproducing. That's only been the last 7 years, maybe 6 or 7 years. So there's a lot of adjustments we've made along the way.
I think the biggest mistake we made was making the wrong person the lead pastor. If we had to do that over again, we would have done that dramatically different. I was going to say, I don't think we were as intentional about developing artists as we could have been. I think that kind of came a little bit later on. And so we didn't really instill this idea of apprenticeship within our group of artists early on in the life of the church. And I think we paid the price for that for probably the first, 2 or 3 years at least. So I would encourage early on, you know, make sure that, because for whatever reason, I think sometimes there's a tendency to not, you know, we think, well, leaders lead, artists do something different. Artists lead also, you know, and we need to hold them accountable to developing other artists. I have one thought. First of all, you have to remind people that relationship is the task. And so for the task-minded people, maybe that helps them kind of reframe. Relationship is the task. And I would go back to the five steps, too. If you recall, I mean, every one of those included the we talk. I do, you help, we talk. I do, you watch, we talk. You do, I help, we talk. And the talk really is the relational piece of that. Yeah, you're in ministry together, but you're doing life together. You're getting together, and you're talking about what it means to develop personally as a leader. And we have some tools that we provide to help facilitate those conversations, too. But overall, I mean, the relationship absolutely is the task.
Are you a staff person at the church, or are you the lead pastor? You're the lead pastor. Well, in that regard, I think you do have more of an opportunity to be. I would say you're the primary culture creator. Okay, I think as part of what we do as leaders, we create culture. If you want to create a culture that values leadership development relationally, I think. I mean, you have the platform on a regular basis now. So if you will have one or two apprentices that you're leading, you find ways because you're doing most of the probably speaking, to work those into your weekend talks as illustrations, okay? And then you also, as other people begin to also do that, then you celebrate those people as the heroes. You can begin to change that culture. We kind of use a model. We talk about see it, get it, do it. And so, like, you want people, first of all, to see you doing it. They see you. They see it, and they go, oh, that's different, right? So there's kind of less aha, and then they start to get it, and the get it part happens in the brain, but also in the heart. The brain goes like, oh, that matches 2 Timothy 2:2. That seems like a discipleship kind of thing. That seems like what Jesus wants. That seems like good theology being practiced, right? They get it up here, but they also get it in their heart because you're telling stories about your apprentice, and you guys are actually friends, like John talked about with Chris. It's not just like a task thing that you're doing, but you're also friends because you're going to baseball games, you're hanging out, and all that kind of stuff. They're going like, oh, that feels good. Man, every time he talks about it, it's like this, there's something going on. So they start to feel in their heart, so they see it. They get it, right? And then as they start doing it, whoever the early adapters are, you start rewarding those people. You know, you tell their stories. You put their picture on the screen and say, hey, this is what we want to see happen over and over and over again. And I think that's how you begin to shift culture. And you're fortunate that you're in that primary leadership role because you can make the change faster than and allow it to cultivate or allow it to actually penetrate the whole culture of the whole church.
It's a great question, and fortunately, you know, having both a church that reproduces locations, multi-site, and also having New Thing, which is our church planting kind of arm, we can really give people options. For the most part, locally, it's been multi-site, and like further away would be church planting, but we've also planted churches locally, too. And so, you know, there's some leaders, they just love the idea of being a part of a, you know, church with multiple locations. They want to be a part of a team. They love the idea of aligning around the same vision. Other leaders, you know, what makes them good but can also make them dangerous is not, I could do it better than anybody else. I'm going to go do this on my own. And chances are that's probably what got us to start a church at one point too. And so, great. We'll help you plan a church. either way, the kingdom expands and God wins, and hopefully more people find their way back to God. All right. Wow, I think we're out of time. Thanks a lot. I'll be hanging around here for a little while if you want to talk more. Glad to talk. If you're available for lunch, we'd love for you to join us at our pizza lunch. Thanks again for being here. You've been great listeners. Thank you.